says, and the expert's name is Quentin R. Dokken, D-O-K-K-E-N, apparently no relation to the former metal band.
Yes.
Quentin R. Dokken says, the sky is not falling. And they identify him as a marine biologist and executive director of the Gulf of Mexico Foundation, a conservation group in Corpus Christi, Texas. We've certainly stepped in a hole, and we're going to have to work ourselves out of it, but it isn't the end of the Gulf of Mexico. But guess, as Brad Friedman points out, guess what the New York Times doesn't do?
What's that?
They don't tell anybody that Mr. Dokken's conservation group, the Gulf of Mexico Foundation, huh, here's the punchline, is sponsored in large part by the offshore drilling industry.
You know,
I remember when they used to teach these classes called journalism ethics in school.
You know, I was reading some of the inside information on the oil rig disaster, and one of the things they said that was really interested me and probably will interest some of the listeners is the fact of how much the culture of oil rig and engineer and knowing your education has changed so much. And basically, from what I was getting at, the details of what this guy who worked on one of these similar oil rigs, he said, the culture has changed so much that nobody reads manuals, nobody reads the books, and they take pride in it.
Well, the books are probably written by English as a second language offshore translators and God knows where. Wow, that was really mean of me, but, you know, I'd have an element of truth. And, you know, here's more fun.
Yeah.
Of the Gulf of Mexico Foundation's board of directors, 19 members have direct ties to the offshore drilling industry. Here's a hoot. One of the board of directors members is actually currently an executive at Transocean. Mm. And that's the company that owns Deepwater Horizon. Nah, we wouldn't want to disclose that to readers or nothing on the national paper of record or anything, now would we? Heck no. Hey, David, I got to roll along. Awful good to hear from you, though.
All right, before I go, everybody check out the show Treme on HBO.
And we spell that how?
T-R-E-M-E.
Good deal. Thanks, David.
All right, later.
Bye now. Pop culture correspondent David calling from Maine. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob?
Yes. Hey, Jim.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing good.
Well, as far as St. Vincent's is concerned, they filed for bankruptcy last month, and they were like $1 billion in the hole.
And that's quick. Why not restore St. Vincent's Hospital instead of restoring Stephen Baldwin?
Well, I totally agree with you, but
sorry,
I understand. I was totally floored by that, but the transfer of function will be from St. Vincent's to Bellevue.
Oh, because they're not overcrowded or anything.
No. And
go. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Monday, no it isn't, Tuesday night edition of The Horn. I have a feeling it's going to be confused like that all night and perhaps for the rest of the week. My apologies for my absence yesterday. Fact of the matter is, it was... Look, the right wing can talk about family values all at once, but they ain't got a lock on it. In fact, I think we can make an argument with a few stories tonight that they have an active dislock on it, the dysfunctional or whatever. But anyway, I was off with Ferg last night. Here in the hills and hollers of wild, wonderful, almost level West by God, Virginia, we have a tradition, an educational tradition. It goes back to 1929, I think it is. I think it is the oldest program of its sort in the country. And it's something called the Golden Horseshoe Program. It's for eighth graders. And eighth grade children all across West Virginia study their little butts off for a test of information relating to West Virginia history, culture, and geography. And very few win the coveted Golden Horseshoe Award. Knights and ladies of the Golden Horseshoe, in fact, they are. And Ferg was one of them. So he was asked to attend the County Board of Education meeting last night, and we did, where he and his other county Golden Horseshoe recipients were honored with mention. And then this Friday he gets knighted. That will not cause me to miss the show. This Friday he gets knighted in a ceremony featuring the governor, etc., down in Charleston. I'll be gone to that. It was a sweet moment. It really, really was. Now, me having been gone last night is a reminder that I need to mention to you that there will be some scheduling weirdness coming in the next week or two. Let's see. Next Monday and Tuesday, I will not be here. I will not be behind the microphone Monday or Tuesday of next week. I will be off in the wilds of Kentucky at a meeting, that which my attendance is required. So there's that. Then we'll have a normal Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. And then it gets weird again at the beginning of next week and throughout that week and the following week, the beginning of the week, because I'm going to be on the road doing some mountaintop removal-related stuff. More announcements coming, if anything, broadcast-worthy comes out of all that. So stay tuned, stay posted. At the top of the next hour, we're going to be having a little conversation with John Fox, the webmaster of The Horn, as well as host of All Foxed Up, technical guru, engineering genius, et cetera, about changes going on at the HeadOnRadioNetwork.com website. I mentioned them toward the end of last week. The redo of the website is in full swing. If you go and you look at the, I'm tickled to death with the new look of the page. I think it's going to be really much, much nicer, much more navigable, and make a heck of a lot more sense. So John has been working like a man possessed on all of those things. So please be patient, bear with us, but it will be fully functional before you know what happened. Part of this was, well, the main reason was to have everything ready and just shiny as a new penny. Both for our trip to Washington, D.C. for the America's Future Now conference in early June, and then more particularly our trip to Netroots Nation in the third week of July. Because we're an Internet-based radio network. Our first and best foot forward is our visual presence on said intertubes. Yeah, John's been pulling 16 to 20 hours a day since Friday. Yeah. I will admit to a little bit of recreation over the past weekend. Agnes and I marked our 17th. Let's see, what is 17th anniversary? Is that paperclip? No, it's stapled. No, it's the Essence of Lemon Pledge. No. But anyway, we passed our 17th wedding anniversary as stunning to you as it probably is to me, or as probably as stunning to you as it actually is to me. I keep looking at it. Wow, you keep hanging around. What did I ever do to deserve you? And I mean that in as nice a sense as is humanly possible, not in, you know, what did I do? No. I'm still a little bit blown away. But she's still here. And we spent a little bit of quality time together, and, well, it was just nice all the way around. So that was part of the weekend. But as the punchline of the joke says, coffee breaks over, back on our heads. And speaking of jokes, I wanted to start out with one of my favorite really terrible, terrible pun jokes. I love this one. I adore this one. You know the old saying, he who would pun would pick a pocket? Yeah. Well, I thought I was reminded of this earlier. And trust me, work with me here. I don't come out and do a take my wife, please, you know, funny guy monologue at the beginning of the program. But I was reminded of this by some weightier and considerably heavier matters. And not the least of which was the fact that, put it this way. An English dandy in the century before last, the late 19th century, shall we say, an English dandy was touring Australia. And it was getting along in the afternoon, and he was out in the bush, and the only thing nearby was a sheep station. Barely much more than a ramshackle the bunkhouse. But he stops there because it's getting on toward late in the afternoon, and he thought he'd like a cup of tea. The English dandy comes in and says, like a spot of tea, she did. If you please. And the fellow there at the station says, right, what do you want? Oh, yeah. And the dandy says, well, I don't know. What sort do you purvey here? Well, the most popular thing around here is our koala. Hey, really? Well, do bring me a pot. So the dandy sits there and waits, and sure enough, the guy brings back a pot and cup, saucer, pours it, and lo and behold, there's all this stuff floating in it. There at the sheep station in the middle of the outback. The only sign over the thing just says Mercy in the middle of the bush, middle of nowhere, little station called Mercy. And like I said, he pours the tea, and there's sticks and stems and leaves and little chunks of flowers or something all just floating in the tea. And the English dandy says, "My good man, what is all of this flotsam, jetsam, floating in my tea?" The fellow looks in and says, must have forgotten to mention. The koala tea of Mercy is not strained. Love that one. Just love it. The koala tea of Mercy is not strained. And I thought of that because of the line from The Merchant of Venice by William Shakespeare, which I was reminded of by the places that my mind was going earlier in the day today, for a variety of reasons. The Merchant of Venice by William Shakespeare, in which Portia speaks to Shylock about mercy itself. The quality of mercy is not strained. It droppeth as the gentle rain from heaven upon the place beneath. It is twice blessed. It blesseth him that gives and him that takes. his mightiest in the mightiest, it becomes the throned monarch better than his crown. His scepter shows the force of temporal power, the attribute to awe and majesty, wherein doth sit the dread and fear of kings, but mercy is above this sceptered sway. It is enthroned in the hearts of kings. It is an attribute of God himself, and earthly power doth then show like God's, when mercy seasons justice. Why was I thinking about that? Because I've been thinking about some of the things that I've been thinking about and talking about. About wanting, for instance, Grover Norquist to be the point of the spear with a plastic bucket standing out in the shallower reaches of the Gulf of Mexico waiting for some of that free market crude to roll up on him so that all those free marketeers, those tea baggers, those babies, those dullards, those insensate fools who do not realize that we either all stand together or we all hang separately, can do their best with the oil slick that they helped cause. Indeed, indeed, indeed. And then I saw another news story later today from the Mobile Press Register. In it, officials in the state of Alabama are crying, "Lord, Lord!" As the book puts it. For that socialist in the White House to federalize the National Guard so that the federal government will be on the dime instead of the state of Alabama when the National Guard begins assisting in the cleanup effort or the prevention effort or whatever effort may be made to deal with the BP horror as it flows and oozes and shinnies toward that exquisite Gulf Coast of Alabama and Mississippi, North Florida, all places, all of them places that are absolutely chock-a-block full of rotten-ass teabagging babies, spoiled rat Randians, who've hollered, "I want to get the government out of my life. I don't want no government. I don't want no socialism. Get out of my life. Tax enough already." And I thought, you miserable bastards. You sorry sons of sea cooks. You want your state's rights, Alabama? Well, how's about you have your state's rights to pay your own damned way and pay for your own National Guard cleanup instead of crying, "Lord, Lord," to that federal government you so thoroughly despise? And then my thoughts moved northward. One meteorologist saying what happened in the Nashville area was something nigh akin to thousand-year floods. And when you're talking about thousand-year floods, you are talking about floods of a biblical proportion, because if you're a literalist about the Old Testament, as so many Southern fundamentalists are, the earth was scarcely 1,000 years old when Almighty, compassionate, and all-loving God decided he'd screwed up and he was going to start all over again, except for Noah. Right. And he sent a flood. Remember the Noah's Ark story with the, you know, the grain supply rooms tucked into a cave that somehow have become Noah's Ark in a cave? Yeah, and you know the story. It's BS. And I thought about the Gaylord Opryland Hotel. Underwater. Screwed. As is much of that lovely, lovely region. Because the Cumberland River escaped its banks in a big way. And I thought about the Gaylord Opryland Hotel, which actually played host to that vile, hate-filled, nasty-ass bagger fest a couple of months ago. And the first thing that came into my mind was, screw them too! Let the miserable, rotten-ass Randians get out and clean up the mess. They don't want no gummit. Taxed enough already. And I thought, screw them. I thought about baggers who had been at the Bagger Fest in Nashville that came after the Bagger Fest in Huntsville, Alabama, where they'd marched around with their little Mao, the Obama as Mao t-shirts, where that loopy-ass Victoria Jackson had sung "There's a Communist in the White House." And for a minute, just for a minute, I think I almost got in touch with the level of disgust of that angry, juvenile, delinquent, old Testament Yahweh when he said, screw them! Noah, you build a boat. Screw the rest of them. And I realized that I had been taken to a very dark and nasty place. That I had been taken to the very place where the goddamn birthers and baggers and deathers and tenthers and booger eaters all live. Because those rotten bastards live in the land of screw 'em. Screw 'em, they're brown. Some of 'em's bound to be illegal. Screw 'em, they're brown. They ain't white and privileged like me. Screw 'em, they're women. They don't have rights to control their own bodies and their own reproductive innards. Screw 'em. And that's the thing about the baggers. They want to screw everybody but themselves. But when trouble comes, they will stick their hands out and proclaim, Lord, Lord. It's only one problem. If you go by the book, when that cry of Lord, Lord comes out, I think the next line is, and I shall say, I knew ye not. And then I thought about Abraham Lincoln. And how he described at Gettysburg a nation of the people, by the people, and for the people. And the context from which that came. The whole sentence. The whole sentence. It is rather for us to be here dedicated to the great task remaining before us. That from these honored dead we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion. That we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain. That this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom. and that that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. Heady words, those. He, of course, speaking of the Union dead at Gettysburg. Those slaughtered thousands. But there are dead in their 20s in Nashville. There are 11 dead from a free market oil rig explosion. There are 29 dead at Upper Big Branch. Another underground coal miner has gone off to meet his maker just this day in West Virginia. Two others recently dead in Kentucky. And they count too. And if we have them at all in our mind, then we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain. That this nation shall have a new birth of freedom. And that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. And that is where I find myself. If we are to have the nation that we say that we believe in, we cannot so quickly say, screw them. We cannot so easily say, to hell with the baggers and the birthers and the deathers and the tenthers and the booger eaters. We can't do it because they too, ignorant and dumber than hell, though they may be, are our fellow Americans. And so it falls to us to rebuild and to clean up. It is to all Americans the cleanup of Nashville. It is to all Americans the salvation of the Gulf Coast. It is all of our responsibilities, all of ours. And if somewhere along the way we get a chance to look at a bagger or a birther or a deather or a tenther or a booger eater and say, you know why we're doing this? You dumbass bagger, you! You know why we're doing this? Because in the Constitution of the United States of America, it says that we, the people, shall provide for the general welfare of ourselves, of the people. And yes, bagger, you're still people, and you're still Americans, even though you would split us in 1,000 different directions asunder. You are still Americans like us. And as far as I'm concerned, we poleaxe them across the head with every good work that we do as we the people, the government of the United States, and we remind them that day in and day out, they would not have surcease of sorrow without us, without the government that we do here ordain shall not perish from the earth. We have built a social safety net. People will be out of work arising out of these troubles, whether they be shrimpers and fishermen on the Gulf Coast or hospitality workers and day laborers in Nashville. And they are all Americans. And if we cannot show mercy among ourselves, how can we ever hope that mercy be shown toward us in any other time of need? The quality of mercy is not strained. It droppeth as the gentle rain from heaven upon the place beneath. It is twice blessed. It blesseth him that gives and him it takes. 'Tis mightiest in the mightiest. It is an attribute of God himself, and earthly power doth then show like God's when mercy seasons justice. For without that, we find ourselves in the land of William Butler Yeats, where the center cannot hold. Coming up, we have a conversation for you. Suzanne Gordon will be joining us momentarily. She has a new book out that I know will be of interest to the many nurses and former nurses in the Horn audience, and there are a significant number of them. Suzanne Gordon is editor of When Chicken Soup Isn't Enough, stories of nurses standing up for themselves, their patients, and their profession. We'll have her on the phone momentarily. You're listening to America's listener-supported liberal voice. You're listening to The Horn. I'm Bob.
From the east. ever stormy sea.
Forgive me if I say that I just love that song. Going back to 1991, Joni Mitchell and Slouching Toward Bethlehem. This is The Horn. It is Tuesday night. Oh, I got it right this time. Yay me. And we are about to be joined on the phone by Suzanne Gordon. She has put together an amazing collection of essays and thought-provoking, I don't want to say reminiscences, but thought-provoking... Well, essays, but pieces of tremendous value that literally span the globe from people who work in the nursing community. It is gathered together under the title, When Chicken Soup Isn't Enough, Stories of Nurses Standing Up for Themselves, Their Patients, and Their Profession. And frankly, the book is profound and of profound importance as we move into the 21st century. Into a world that is very well likely not adequately served in terms of the numbers of healthcare professionals that we will need, and also is damaged in its own right by virtue of the way that nursing professionals are treated in this country. The book is from Cornell University Press, and I encourage you to read it as I have. Having read this book, you will never look at another nurse quite the same way, and your respect, already high, will be made manifestly more so. Suzanne Gordon, thank you for joining us on the program. I really appreciate your time.
Oh, thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure, and let's take care of a couple of the preliminaries, if you will. You are not only a journalist, not only a writer, you've appeared in any number of periodicals and publications, but you are a nurse and a teacher of nurses in your own right, correct?
No, I'm not a nurse. That's what makes me different. I'm not a nurse. I've been writing about nursing for about 25 years of my 40-year career as a journalist who is not a nurse. My father is actually a famous doctor, and I discovered nursing when I was 38 years old and had my first child in a small community hospital outside of Boston, and realized that I thought the doctors, and one of whom was a really close friend, was going to be the most important person to me, and discovered that it was really the nurses.
I've been talking
about nursing ever since, so that's about 1985-ish.
Well, my apologies for getting that part of it backwards.
That's a great compliment. But I do teach. I am a visiting professor at the University of Maryland School of Nursing.
Well, see, that's what threw me.
Right?
You are a visiting professor at the University of Maryland School of Nursing. You're also an assistant adjunct professor at the University of California, San Francisco School of Nursing.
Right.
I think I sort of took that as a stepping off point to the assertion that you must surely be a nurse.
Right, and a lot of people think that, but I'm not. But I have been writing about nursing for years and try to convey to the public what it is that nurses do and why they're so important, which I think most people don't understand. I think a lot of people think nurses are nice, they think they're honest, they think they're ethical, but they don't really understand that their care is a matter of life and death, that their research is a matter of life and death, and that nurses, when they advocate for patients, aren't just patting them on the head, that they're really often going to the mat and taking huge risks and arguing for changes in public policy or hospital policy or respect from people like doctors who all too often don't really listen to nurses. And, I mean, I was just in a small hospital in rural Wisconsin yesterday speaking, and somebody was telling me that, you know, sometimes they have to deal with physicians who, you know, if a nurse calls them in the middle of the night, will get testy or even hang up on them. And I'm thinking, like, you know, would a pilot hang up on air traffic control? I mean, it's just like, what are we doing here? You know?
Well, this topic has special relevance for me because, as I mentioned at the top of the program before you were on the line, my wife and I celebrated our 17th wedding anniversary this past weekend. And when we married, she left the nursing profession. She decided she wanted to raise a family and be there for the family, but she has never stopped being, you know, it's kind of nice. We've got our own personal nurse in the house. But she has told me those stories, Ms. Gordon, of precisely such a thing, of being sworn at by a physician in the middle of the night.
Yeah, I mean, it's really astonishing that in this day and age, when patients' lives hang in the balance, that doctors are not taught that that's, like, just, I mean, it's so out of bounds that it's incredible. And one of the sections in this book is called Excuse Me, Doctor, and there's all kinds of stories of nurses who, you know, who have a lot of knowledge and skill and are dealing with a doctor in training or dealing with a doctor who's an attending physician and really doesn't get it, and the nurse really has to take risks that she shouldn't have to take or he shouldn't have to take in dealing with physicians who should regard nurses as teachers, as collaborators, as colleagues. I mean, one of the stories is a transplant nurse who is very skilled in dealing with a resident who is a doctor in training and not very experienced. And she recognizes that a guy who's had a kidney transplant is rejecting the kidney, and she can tell way before the lab values come back with numbers that reflect this. And she knows that from his demeanor, and he's sluggish, and his, you know, his urine output and various things like that, that he's rejected the kidney, and that he needs to go right back to the OR immediately and get a new kidney. And the resident says, oh, no, you know, and is dawdling. And the nurse basically just calls the attending and says, Joe or whatever, you know, get in here. And Joe gets in there, and she's right, and they give the guy a new kidney, and he's fine. But, you know, people have to function as teams. And when the nurse calls you in the middle of the night, she's not calling to ask how your golf game is, you know. And it's really amazing. And, you know, the healthcare system is very hierarchical, and people are not taught to respect each other's input, and one hears this all the time.
Well, let me, without a doubt, is that in the course of the book, beyond the stories themselves, is there, what is the remedy then?
Well, I really think that the title says it all. You know, that nurses are really fed a lot of pablum about their work. They end up sometimes talking about their work as if though it's all sugar and spice and everything nice. You know, I've been at, you know, around this time of year, it's Nurses Week, and hospitals are are recognizing nurses for their clinical excellence and their excellence practice. And a really good nurse is someone who is able to be reassuring and comforting and also is technically savvy and medically knowledgeable and really knows about medications and infection control and make sure you don't get a blood clot. And I'm really struck all the time by how much nursing and nurses encourages a sort of sugar and spice and everything nice narrative and storyline, when in fact what nurses do is really function very astutely, very innovatively, very courageously in all kinds of situations, and yet they're fed this chicken soup for the soul kind of sugar and spice narrative, and this book is really deliberately contradicting. Sorry, I'm so sorry to sneeze on the air.
Bless you.
Is contradicting that image and saying, no, this is what real great nursing looks like. These are the people that have made the profession what it is, and this is what most nurses do, but they kind of cover it up. It's like, you know, when I was a girl growing up in the late 50s and early 60s, it was like my mother wanted me, you know, to sort of attract boys because I was supposed to get married, and she was always happy when I had a date, but she would always warn me before I went out, you know, don't show them you're too smart or they'll get scared of you and run away. And I think that nursing is still imbued with a lot of that. And, I mean, you know, if you look at the way nursing tells its own story, sometimes you would be hard-pressed to know how smart and innovative and courageous these people are. And I don't mean just fancy nurses with PhDs. I mean the ordinary, everyday bedside nurse, the nurse in home care and schools and rehab hospitals. And they're tough cookies.
I never viewed it as anything except a very, very gritty job that I would never have the guts to do.
And I think, I mean, it's the guts, but it's also the brains. You know, you have to have the guts and the brains, and it's a profession that requires enormous self-discipline because, you know, when you're dealing with a patient with an ugly wound or who's in big trouble, you know, your natural inclination is to run in the opposite direction, and nurses are running in the direction of the patient, but sometimes you wouldn't know it if you didn't get underneath this. And so one of the reasons why I assembled these stories from 73 nurses, mostly in the U.S., but some in Canada and Australia and Italy and Spain and lots of other countries, is because I really wanted to say to nurses, look, you've got to come out of the closet. You know, you've got to come out of the brain closet and show people that, you know, what you can do when chicken soup isn't enough. And most of the time, unfortunately, it's not. And believe me, I mean, I'm Jewish and I'm into chicken soup, you know. It's Jewish penicillin, but it doesn't always work. And
well, I do take it that you've got a little bit of disdain for the sort of chicken soupization of all things of the modern scope of problems. When we talk about it in terms of nursing, the fact of the matter is, when we get past this patina, this gloss, if you will, Ms. Gordon, it is not so much nurses as the absence of them that creates so many of the problems inside our medical establishment, isn't it?
Right. Well, I think that if you have this sort of chicken soupy, sugar and spicy view of nurses as kind of handholders and sweet and nice and smiley, you know, you don't understand how critical they are and how important they are to preventing deaths and complications. And so, you know, you're not going to hire enough of them. You're going to burden them with too many patients. And most nurses, with the exception of the state of California and other places where there are unions that have negotiated, say, staffing ratios in their contracts, most places are, you know, the nurses are taking care of 6 or 7 patients on the days, you know, maybe overnight, you know, 10 patients, and there's just not enough nurses. And hospitals are insisting on unrealistic ratios. There's a huge debate in nursing about, say, what's called safe nurse-to-patient ratios, which means that you can't give a nurse when they come into an acute care hospital, more than X number of patients in California on medical surgical floors, which are the majority of floors, it's five. It probably should be four or three sometimes. And in most states, it's more. And, you know, hospitals argue that we shouldn't have ratios, that hospitals need flexibility, and that there's no evidence that these ratios that were enacted in California in 1999 and implemented in 2004 are really good for patients. And a number of the stories in the book are about nurses fighting for these ratios. And, in fact, just the other week, a couple weeks ago, one of the rock stars of nursing research, Linda Aiken, and a number of her rock star colleagues put out a study in Health Services Research Journal, and they've actually done a very, very serious look at the California ratios and compared them to two states in which there are no ratios, New Jersey and Pennsylvania, and showed that there would, if New Jersey and Pennsylvania had ratios, 13% and 10% of people, 13.9 and 10.6, I believe, is percent of people wouldn't have died. And there's greater satisfaction in California hospitals among nurses, better recruitment, better retention. And, you know, the reality is it's just kind of a no-brainer. I mean, it's easier to take care of, you know, five patients than 10 patients. And, you know, just like we have ratios in schools and in daycare, and we have, you know, one flight attendant for every 50 seats in an airplane, and if there's 51 passengers, there's an extra flight attendant. You know, we need some control of the nurse workload if patients are going to live.
Well, let me ask then. We can talk about ratios, but if you don't have the people there to fill them, where does that leave us? Is this a function of lack of students, is it a pay issue,
it's a workload issue. I mean, when they started cutting nurses in the 90s in the name of restructuring and, I don't know, managed care, they started overloading nurses, and people started not, you know, they were laying off people so people didn't go into nursing. And then they were, like, making the work so terrible that people didn't want to stay in nursing. And now, and so what has happened is, and we haven't adequately funded nursing education. I mean, the new Obama health plan is going to add something like 31 million patients to insurance rolls in 2014, just in time for the baby boomer nurses to begin retiring. And we are not producing enough nurses to handle the glut of people who will be needing nursing services. And if we don't start now, I mean, it takes, you know, 4 to 10 years to produce an expert nurse. You just can't start in 2014 and say, oh my gosh, we've got all these people, many of them are going to end up in hospitals, because they haven't had primary care and preventive services, and we don't have enough nurses. You can't say that in 2014 and then say, where's the nurses, and click your fingers or turn on the faucet and expect to have hot and cold running nurses. You have to begin to prepare now for the need in the future. Now, hospitals have declared the nursing shortage to be over because of the recession, because a lot of nurses have gone back into the workforce. But if their vacancies were a function of one nurse to six or seven or eight patients, then they may fill their vacancy, but patients may not be getting enough nursing care because these people are incredibly sick and the nurse just can't be in, you know, 8 or 9 or 10 places at once.
Well, obviously they are human, not superhuman. With that in mind, then, how do we move toward better staffing ratios? And secondly, separate question: is the problem greater in for-profit or not-for-profit such as it is, facilities?
Well, for-profit hospitals, because, I mean, not-for-profit hospitals act badly enough, but for-profit hospitals are really act badly. And studies have shown conclusively that for-profit hospitals spend about 11% less on clinical care, and that means nurses. And but even not-for-profit hospitals are not adequately funding nursing care, and, you know, they have ratios now. It's called, you know, they budget for a certain level of productivity, which is called nursing hours per patient day, and if you need more nurses, the manager will not be given those nurses because these are the productivity levels that management expects. And I think nurses, you know, the hope of my writing this book is more nurses will really come out and fight for whatever it is they need. It may be ratios. It may be research. It may be better relationships with doctors. It may be better relationships with other nurses. It may be better understanding, public understanding of nursing. But nurses have to fight for it, and they can't, you know, kind of hide under this protection of this chicken soupy sugar and spice cover. They have to show what they really know and what they really do to each other and to the public.
And as we consider what you're discussing there, Ms. Gordon, what role does representation or lack thereof by a union play in the overall plight?
Well, I think that unionization, depending on which union you choose, really is critical because in the U.S. at least, there's no protected speech in the workplace. The First Amendment doesn't apply to the workplace. So if you consider yourself to be patient advocate and you say something the hospital doesn't like, they can fire you. I mean, one of the nurses in the book, Barry Adams, talks about his struggle in a hospital where he had no union protection, and he raised the issue of patient deaths, and he was fired. And he had to go to court, and because he worked with two other nurses who backed him up, he was able to get his job back because it was protected concerted activity, i.e. there was more than one person making these concerns known. And he was actually responsible for whistleblower legislation. He was sort of the poster boy for whistleblower legislation in healthcare in Massachusetts, where I live. We just had an instance in Texas where two nurses in a public hospital, non-union, three nurses raised an anonymous complaint to the Texas Board of Medicine about a physician who was doing surgical procedures that he wasn't supposed to be doing and selling medicines to patients under duress. And the sheriff somehow wheedled out of the Board of Medicine who had waged this complaint. And the nurses were fired, and the sheriff and the county attorney charged two of them with a felony, and one of them was tried and ultimately acquitted. But, you know, the message to nurses in Texas and around the country is, you know, you challenge a doctor and you can be fired, and they were not reinstated, and you have to spend thousands of dollars on legal costs. This happened to a nurse in Pasadena several years ago at Huntington Memorial Hospital, where she did something an intern didn't like for the safety of a patient. He reported her for insubordination. She was fired and so forth. And, you know, you don't have to do that too many times. It's really a patient safety issue. You know, if a nurse says something that a doctor disagrees with, the proper response is to thank the nurse for her concern and to have a chat with her about why she may be wrong or whatever. The proper response, unless somebody, you know, takes a gun and shoots a patient, is not to fire that nurse.
Well, and you recount that there are stories within the book by your various authors of absolute, well, like the what you just described with responding by going after the job. There are other examples of absolutely callous disregard for the lives of nursing personnel. Early in the book, I was just sort of thrown back in my chair by the remarks of the CEO in Wisconsin that led to nurses donning bridal gowns. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, this was the CEO of a big hospital chain, and it wasn't the CEO who said this. It was
Their negotiator, yes.
It was the negotiator for the hospital system, and they were about to, they were trying to cut the pensions, the paltry pensions of older nurses, and the Candace Alley, who wrote the story, who is the president of the Wisconsin Nurses and Health Professionals, was talking to the negotiator and said, you know, it's outrageous that you're doing this. And the guy said, well, you know, if nurses want security in their old age, they should marry well. And so instead of just having a fit, the nurses in this union fanned out across Milwaukee and bought bridal gowns in secondhand stores and veils and put the veils under their nurses' caps and dressed in the bridal gowns and went, hired a bus, and went to the corporate headquarters with a big banner to the CEO, who was making millions of dollars and had this huge pension plan, and with this banner saying, marry me. And it was covered by all the media, and they eventually had to fight even more. That wasn't enough, and they got a settlement that was favorable. But I think this is a great example of when chicken soup isn't enough, the cleverness and innovative nature of what nurses do and what they do together. And there was another example of a school nurse. School nurses are wildly underappreciated, and I was just speaking to school nurses in the state of Wisconsin, and their ratio of children in schools to a nurse is 2,300 to 1. And these kids have huge problems coming, you know, to school with ventilators and asthma and seizures, and they're expected to take care of these kids. And a school nurse in Kansas was struggling with a principal who wanted to cut back on the hours of the nurse in the school, and so she said to him, well, what kinds of problems do the kids in your school have? Do they have asthma? And he said, yes, you know, some of them have asthma. And she said, well, I guess managing an inhaler could be delegated to a non-nurse. And then she said, does anybody in the school have epilepsy? And do any of them need this medicine called Diastat, which is a seizure control medication? And he said, well, yes, there is a kid. And she said, well, you know, this medication has to be, it's a rectal form of Valium. So she explained how this rectal suppository, it's kind of like,
oh dear,
you know, giving an enema, had to be inserted. And she said, you know, you could be asked to do this, to administer this medication. And he goes, oh, you know what? I just remembered some money that we could spend on school nurses. Well, again, you know, that's the cleverness of a nurse who realizes what to do when chicken soup isn't enough.
What on the patient side of this, beyond a mere appreciation for the hard and, as you note, smart work that nurses do, what role does a patient play in terms of the interplay and in terms of trying to learn about the healing process or the caring process? Does that present a greater challenge than, say, the physician relationship, or
no? I think that the patient has to understand that it will take more than a doctor to make them well and to take care of them, particularly if they're in a hospital or in home care or anywhere, nursing homes, etc. And patients need to ask more about nursing. I mean, if you're going to go into a hospital and for an elective or even an emergency procedure where there's some time, then you should be asking questions about how many nurses are on the floor. I mean, I was recently, unfortunately, in that situation 3 years ago. I had an appendicitis, and a small hospital. I went as Middlebury, Vermont, and I went into the hospital, and they said that, you know, I should have an operation, and I didn't have the wit, even though I should have known better, to say, what's your staffing ratio, because I could have gone, you know, 30 minutes to Burlington, to Fletcher Allen, where I think they have a ratio on med surgical floors of 1 to 3 or 1 to 4. And I ended up in this hospital, Porter Hospital, where they had 1 to 7, and I ended up with a serious complication that was completely preventable with better nursing care. So,
is that is that the biggest question an entering patient should ask?
Well, it's one of them. I mean, you know, how many operations like this has your surgeon done? What's your infection rate, which is, of course, tied to nurse staffing, but it's also tied to other things, and how many nurses per patient are on the floor that you're admitted to. I mean, unless you have no time at all. And, you know, the more patients ask that question, you know, I mean, there's also other questions you can ask. Are your nurses board certified? I mean, are they certified in wound care and critical care and so forth? But, you know, I think we as consumers of healthcare, I hate that term,
and
have
me too.
We can have a lot of impact.
Well, on the other end of it, since you do spend considerable time inside the educational system where nursing is concerned, and having mentioned the sugar and spice and the chicken soupiness of it all, what does a young person, and it is no longer, I think, appropriate to think mainly of women, but what does a young person entering the nursing profession really need to know in terms of reality as opposed to any of that glossing?
It's tough work. It's scientific work. You need brains and not just heart, and your heart is guided by your brains, and you need a lot of knowledge. And a lot of times in nursing education, students are taught really to focus on the emotional aspect of the profession, not on the scientific aspects and the medical and technological savvy. And I think it has to be a combination of all of those things.
What about physical demands?
Very, very physically demanding, and it doesn't have to be. I think nurses should not be working 12-hour shifts. Nobody who's a nurse out there listening is going to like that. But, you know, nurses are killing themselves because they want to work 12 hours because the work is very difficult and the environment isn't a good one. And I think nurses should they have given up the 8-hour day. That's a big mistake. There's an epidemic of obesity in American nursing. It's because they're in chronic stress response. And because they don't get enough sleep, and they're literally doing themselves damage by working not only too hard but too long. I think nurses need to reject this notion, and this is in the book, you know, that there's a section in the book called Not Part of the Job Description, that violence against nurses is just, you know, if you can't take the heat, get out of the kitchen. One of the nurses who writes in a story in the book is Charlene Richardson from the Mass Nurses Association, and she was attacked by a patient in the ER, and her hospital didn't support her when she was going to press felony charges, and she was responsible, really, or very active in fighting for legislation to protect hospital workers from violence, and it's a bill that just passed a couple weeks ago in the Massachusetts legislature. Sure. And this is the kind of thing that students of nursing need to know about. When they're told that they are patient advocates, they need to know what patient advocacy really means. And patient advocacy doesn't mean, I wish you the best, I'm out of here. It means making public the needs of the patient, whether the public is just another physician or a manager, and also their own needs. I mean, the subtitle of this book is The Stories of Nurses Standing Up for Themselves, Their Patients, and Their Profession. And I very much insisted on that, you know, putting in nurses standing up for themselves, because nurses are often exhorted to stand up for their patients and to sacrifice themselves. And, of course, nursing involves a certain amount of self-sacrifice. If a patient is crashing, you don't say, oh, I'm sorry, I'm on my break. But, nurses do need to eat lunch. They do need to go to the bathroom. They do need to get home. They have a right to a life. And, you know, it should not be the part of the job description asking nurses to lift a 250-pound or even a 100-pound patient. One of the stories in the book is by Martha Baker in Florida, who works at Jackson Hospital in Miami and is a union president, and her union fought for safe lifting equipment in the hospital because this kind of equipment, which pays for itself in 2 years, is not standard, and we lose 6 to 11% of nurses each year to back, neck, and shoulder injuries. It's completely unnecessary, but hospitals aren't going to do it unless they're forced to do it.
And
this is a positive example. So I think you asked a question about what can the public do. Well, when the public hears about staffing ratio bills or you know, safe lifting bills, the public should support it, because what's good for nurses is often good for the public. I mean, if a nurse is lifting a patient who's too heavy, not only is she going to hurt her back or her neck or her shoulders, but she's going to, you know, drag the patient. That'll shear their skin. It sets them up for a very costly and painful bed sore. She could drop the patient. And so in the case of, like, lift equipment, what's good for the nurse is good for the patient. It's same is true of staffing ratios, as we've seen with this Linda Aiken study. You know, having a less excessive workload means that the nurse will be able to figure out, you know, if you're going to have a cardiac arrest or if you have a cardiac arrest, you know, she's not going to be able to tell that you're having an arrest if she's in room 8 and you're in room 1, you know.
Sure.
I mean, so again, for example, in Michigan, the Michigan Nurses Association is fighting for staffing ratios, and people in Michigan often respond like, you know, well, gee, you have a job and we don't, and why are you complaining? Well, the unemployed person in Michigan should be happy that a nurse has a job, because her job or his job is to save their life. And if they think that they're going to have problems saving somebody's life, the patients and public should be happy that nurses are complaining, because they're complaining not for themselves alone, but for patients as well.
The other thing that struck me out of the book, Ms. Gordon, is the fact that many of these issues cross national boundaries. We recently witnessed a really, really nasty debate in this country that has elements that are ongoing about what kind of healthcare system we want. But within the role of nursing itself, it seems that the issues that confront people in that profession not only cross national boundaries, but also philosophical boundaries of healthcare systems themselves. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the situation of nursing is better in countries where you have a national health system. I mean, the nurse and where you have and in those kind of countries, you also have nurses' unions, and the majority of nurses are in unions. So, I mean, if you look at Scandinavia, which has some of the best healthcare systems in the world, they also have the most powerful nurses, the best ratios, the best pay, the best pensions. But you know, the problems of nurses and doctors, the problems of the public not understanding what nurses do, is very prevalent all over. I mean, in Switzerland, one of the stories in the book is the Swiss Nurses Association coming out with a logo or an image of a nurse as a sort of female superhero, you know, like a kind of a Superman, and they called her Power Nurse, and they were trying to change the image of nurses in Switzerland so they could get better pay and better working conditions. I mean, you have similar problems with staffing and cutbacks in nursing in many other countries. But, like, you know, there's a very, very good story about very good ratios that were won in the state of Victoria in Australia. And, you know, I've been impressed when I've gone to other countries and looked at healthcare systems in other countries at how they solve problems that we have a lot more effectively, and they deliver better care. and they also have more money to spend on nursing care, even if nurses still have problems in those countries.
Have nursing professionals, and I've kept you over a little bit, and I'll let you go. But have nursing professionals also been forced into a situation of internecine rivalry with the difference between the RN, the LPN, and the CNA?
Yeah, there's a terrible problem within nursing, and one of the sections in the book deals with nurse-nurse relationships. I think there's a tendency for RNs to think they're better than LPNs and nurse practitioners to think they're better than the bedside nurse. And, you know, I think that each category of person who gives nursing care has a very particular job to do. But I think that, you know, what we need to recognize is that the nurse has to have a lot of knowledge to give care today, because nurses have always been as technologically and scientifically advanced as the culture in which they function and the era in which they function, and we live in a high-tech medical era. So, you know, if we're going to replace LPNs with RNs, then we need to give LPNs more education and pay them for, you know, doing the level of work that they're doing. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, women getting paid less than men. I mean, if you're doing RN work, you should be paid an RN salary, and you should be given the education necessary. And once we get people paid as much as they deserve, then we won't have this pressure all the time to replace people with cheaper labor, because cheaper labor is cheaper, usually because they don't have as much education. And it isn't, you know, a question of whether the person is better or not. And I just think nurses have to stop fighting each other and start fighting for better health care, and I think that's true of nurses and physicians. They should both be fighting for a better health care system. We've got to start here. It's certainly not the end of the story. Obama is not going to be the last president to deal with health care, and I think nurses and doctors need to get together to fight for a system where they aren't sacrificing themselves and where they are able to give good care. And I think that there's a tremendous pressure on doctors and nurses to work harder, particularly people in primary care, to work to give more with less. And we need to, you know, give more to people who are providing direct care, whether they're primary care physicians or bedside nurses.
That's been very much our reality here, Ms. Gordon. I'm in West Virginia, of course. And
Jamie Oliver.
There you go. But we see, for instance, and this is by no means a denigration. I intend that not in this fashion, but rather as a commentary on the failure of our physician training system, which is another discussion altogether.
Yeah, right. I have a lot to say about that, too.
Well, because on the one hand, if I get a cold or the flu or something and I go down the street, my trusted healthcare professional is a physician's assistant. He's not a physician. He is enabled by the state of West Virginia to write prescriptions and to do do basically all form of primary care doctoring.
Right.
Someone else in the hall may be a CNP, a certified nurse practitioner.
Right.
You may go in for surgery, and instead of having an anesthesiologist, you have a certified nurse anesthetist.
Right.
It strikes me that within this framework, what we're trying to account for is the fact that we cannot get traditional physicians into these roles, and we are making up for it on the backs of another form of professionals, and yet not paying them the same money, as you've mentioned.
Right, and I mean, you have to account for, I mean, there has to be a differential in training, you know. I mean, you put 4 years to becoming a nurse practitioner, or 3 years, and, you know, you put, like, you know, 8 years to becoming a doctor or a physician or something. Well, there has to be something in the payment scheme to account for that. You know, I think
right.
that we have to figure out the payment, and we also have to figure out the workforce needs.
And I guess that another way of looking at that question then would be, is the traditional Is the traditional MD model on the way out, given the vast and expanding needs that we have in this country?
Well, I think we need primary care physicians. I mean, I do believe that we need primary care physicians and nurse practitioners and physician's assistants. But we have to, I think that medical and nursing care should be free. And pharmacy care, and, I mean, medical and nursing and pharmacy and things like healthcare education should be free. And if we dealt with that, we would have more people go into nursing and medicine, and we would have a better split. I mean, most other countries, and many of them have nurse practitioners, have a 50-50 split of primary care doctors and specialists. And we need that too in the United States. And, but we also need doctors and nurses who are trained to cooperate with each other and respect what each other do and listen to each other and learn teamwork and negotiation. I mean, I'm writing a book with a medical educator and a pilot now about the changes in the aviation industry that produced a very, very safe aviation culture in commercial aviation. And we don't have a safe culture in healthcare, and if you read the book, you'll see, you know, what kinds of the ways in which people are not trained to deal with each other. I mean, as I said in the very beginning of this interview, you know, the very idea that a physician could get away with hanging up on a nurse is just extraordinary. And I think if patients knew that, they would go ballistic. So maybe one question to ask your doctor is, do you listen to nurses?
Indeed, indeed.
What happens when my nurse calls you in the middle of the night? I hope you're going to come in here. You know, and that's true of doctors with each other. I mean, surgeons will not listen to ICU doctors because they own the patient, and the whole system needs to be revamped, and the Obama legislation does not deal with quality of care. It deals only with access to for-profit private insurance.
And if you have tons of quantity but low quality, you're almost worse off than when you started, aren't you?
No, I wouldn't say that. I mean, I think this is a beginning, but we have to build on it.
And so with that, do you have a sense, based on your inside knowledge of the profession, Ms. Gordon, do you have a sense for whether or not the nurse, can you make a generalized statement as to which way the nursing profession would fall vis-a-vis something like a universal single-payer scheme?
Well, I think that it would be better for everybody. It would be better for nurses and for patients. I mean, it's much easier to innovate when you have a system than when you're doing it hospital by hospital or, you know, nursing home by nursing home. You've got 5,000-plus hospitals and God knows how many nursing homes and rehab facilities. So having a, you know, some sort of universal system, it may not be the classical single payer. I mean, France, the Netherlands, Scandinavia, these are all models that are different than like Canada and the UK. But I think nursing, I mean, you know, if you liberate money from the for-profit hospitals and for-profit insurance companies and advertising and marketing, you have more money for nursing. I mean, who needs to see an advertisement in the New York Times or the Washington Post, a full-page ad that costs $100,000 telling you, you know, about the wonderful physicians at this hospital or even the wonderful nurses at that hospital when you could be spending that money on nursing? Wouldn't you rather spend it on the salary?
Exactly. We dealt with an issue very similar to that several years ago. And in fact, it had a little hand in my being going to the internet from terrestrial radio. We had nurses standing up for patient rights at a little place called Beckley Appalachian Regional Hospital, and they were disciplined for setting up an informational picket on their day off and not even on hospital property.
Well, and yeah, there you have it. You know, and there was a strike recently, and there's a strike going on at Temple University. I don't know if it's been resolved, where the hospital wanted as part of the gag or a part of the contract that nurses could not talk, could not say anything to the public that would, you know, tarnish the corporate image of the hospital. Well, if nurses can't say that things are going badly for patients, we're in really big trouble.
And right, but I'm sure there was no similar gag order with regard to the hospital even though it be a nonprofit, perhaps doing advertising on the radio or on television.
Of course not. Absolutely.
No, because the skies are not cloudy all day, and never a discouraging word
right.
is heard.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, well, we and that's why I asked the question earlier about nonprofits, because this was the situation that I had some involvement in was a nonprofit hospital, and we kept looking at each other, folks who weren't closely associated with the medical profession, asking ourselves, why does it, honestly, in a little tiny community like Beckley, West Virginia, that has two hospitals, why does a hospital need to run advertising? Why does a not-for-profit hospital need to advertise when everybody knows there's two hospitals?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's a total waste of money.
And money that could very well be spent, oh, I don't know, hiring a couple of more nurses on any given floor or on any given shift.
They really need to do.
Well, Ms. Gordon, thank you very kindly. It's been a very much enlightening conversation for me, and I hope for the Horn audience as well. Tell me one last thing. How did you pull all of these disparate people from all over the planet together for this book?
Well, I put out a call, and I got my potluck, and I edited the stories, and it was kind of like herding cats, but it ended up, I think, pretty well.
It ended up very well. It was a compelling read, and it was an informative read. And I'll tell you the truth, it's a little bit of a scary read, too.
Oh, my gosh. Don't scare them. How listening it is.
No, it is. But when you realize, as you note, we got problems to solve.
We do, but these nurses are solving them. And that's what's so important, I think, about this book, is that these are positive stories of actions that people have taken and they have worked.
And that's it seems that there are resolutions to the problems presented, and that is definitely the upside.
Right.
And getting the nursing population to stand together and continue to address them in this fashion is, I hope, is this book is it more an advocacy book that you want read inside the nursing community or something that you want to generate grassroots activism on the outside?
Well, I really hope that nurses will read this book, but my fondest hope is that nurses will give this book to a non-nurse to show what nurses know and what nurses do and how important nurses are to the public health. So it's not just for nurses only, and I hope that I know, in fact, more nurses will be tempted to buy it than non-nurses will be tempted to buy it for a nurse for, like, Nurses Day or Nurses Week, which is coming up next week, and Nurses Year or Nurses Graduation or Christmas for a nurse. But I recommend that if you're doing that, you ought to give it a read, too.
And your home website is, of course, Suzanne Gordon, Suzanne Gordon, GORDON.com. As far as acquiring the book, do you have a preferred means of purchase?
No, I like independent bookstores, but if you go to Amazon, you can get it there. You can go to the Cornell University Press website you can go to your local bookstore.
All right. Well, Suzanne Gordon, thank you very much, and I appreciate your time, and I very much appreciate the conversation. It has been an engaging one.
Thank you so much.
Take care.
Okay, bye.
Bye now. Suzanne Gordon, editor of When Chicken Soup Isn't Enough, Stories of Nurses Standing Up for Themselves, Their Patients, and Their Profession. It is not a technical manual. It is a series of stories, and they are largely success stories. There is scary stuff in there, but they are scary things that get solved. It's not just hanging out there. But, for instance, if you there are advocacy things. She talks about nurses as a patient advocate. We, as potential patients, I prefer that over healthcare consumer, a phrase Ms. Gordon doesn't like either. But as potential patients, there are things that we can do on the front end because, as Ms. Gordon notes, the work is not done. The work has barely begun. As we try to move forward into some sort of more enlightened healthcare system. And if you go to the front page of SuzanneGordon.com, there is more writing about staffing ratios. A major research study has documented the direct connection between California staffing ratios and reductions in patient deaths and complications. Real numbers. Nursing staff issues are held responsible for 50% of ventilator-related deaths, 42% of surgery-related deaths, 25% of transfusion errors, 19% of medicine errors, 14% of patient falls, and 14% of patient suicides. That's not to say the nursing was bad. That is to say that the nurses were overtaxed, overworked, and overextended. It is the staffing ratios, the staffing issues. And those are management issues. And in situations where hospitals are pursuing profit, guess what gets sacrificed in the name of maximizing those profits? So again, get it through your favorite bookseller. I, too, prefer independent booksellers, but get it anywhere. When chicken soup isn't enough, stories of nurses standing up for themselves, their patients, and their profession, edited by Suzanne Gordon, and you can also stop by SuzanneGordon.com and learn a lot more. Coming up, conversation, other stories, and more. We'll take a little break. On the way, Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen with the Green News Report. It's Tuesday. It must be time for Brad and Desi. This is America's listener-supported liberal voice. You know the number, 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on your nickel, 304-658-3333. Email rolls into Bob Kincaid, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D, at gmail.com. This is The Horn.
Thank you. true.
It's Tuesday, May 4th, 2010.
Water, water everywhere, but not a drop to drink in Boston and Nashville. Storms take lives in the South. Plus,
every American affected by this spill should know this. Your government will do whatever it takes for as long as it takes to stop this crisis.
Slow motion economic and ecological disaster in the Gulf going from bad to worse.
Much worse. All of that and more straight ahead. I'm Brad Friedman of BradBlog.com.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
The cap and trade bill was strongly criticized by hardcore environmentalist wackos. So, what better way to head off more oil drilling, nuclear plants, than by blowing up a rig? I'm just noting the timing here.
And I'm just noting that you are a jackass, Rush Limbaugh. This is your Green News Report. Today's Green News Report is brought to you by Velvet Revolution's StopTheChamber.com, calling for the arrest of U.S. Chamber of Commerce Director and Massey Energy CEO Don Blankenship following the recent deaths of 29 miners in his company's West Virginia coal mine. Blankenship and Massey were cited thousands of times for safety violations and have so far escaped real accountability. Help VR see Blankenship and other U.S. Chamber of Commerce corporate criminals put behind bars. Sign on and support StopTheChamber.com today. All right, Desi Doyen, things are indeed going from bad to worse in the Gulf of Mexico. It's remarkable, as we were discussing over the weekend, we could be looking at what could indeed be the worst man-made ecological disaster in the history of the world here, perhaps shy of Chernobyl, perhaps even exceeding it.
Well, there is the possibility that it can get there unless BP finds a way to cap that oil well. But we'll get to that story in a moment. First, a couple of quick headlines. Another series of deadly storms in the South killed at least 29 people over the weekend, 18 of them in Tennessee, dropping nearly 2 feet of rain in 2 days in some areas. Downtown Nashville is now under 10 feet of water. The death toll is expected to rise as the waters begin to recede today.
That was half a year's water in a single weekend in Nashville. Rather extraordinary.
An order to boil all water has been lifted for 2 million people in the greater Boston area after a 10-foot water main ruptured on Saturday. The cause is under investigation. Stores were accused of price gouging as residents cleared store shelves of bottled water. And that's also going to cost the city later in dealing with the sudden jump in plastic water bottle waste. The fallout from the BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico has some wide-ranging consequences. California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger reversed his position on drilling off the coast of California yesterday.
I see on TV the birds drenched in oil, the fishermen out of work, the massive oil spill, the oil slick destroying our precious ecosystem. That would not happen here in California. And this is why I'm withdrawing my support for the T-Ridge project.
The now-canceled proposal would have used existing oil platforms already off the California coast to explore for more oil. The revenue was intended to fill a $100 million shortfall in the state park system budget.
I must say I'm happy to see somebody out there, some politician, responding to the direct effects of this oil spill. It is remarkable to me that the Obama administration, that the Democrats have not used what's going on down there, this disaster in the Gulf, to push for climate change and clean energy legislation now, the legislation that was supposed to be delivered last week. Where are the Democrats? Why aren't they taking advantage of what I hate to call it, but this opportunity to point out how important this legislation is?
This is where big nature is now confronting big oil.
That was Larry Schweiger of the National Wildlife Federation on the environmental impact of the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. It was 2 weeks ago today that the explosion occurred on the Deepwater Horizon rig, killing 11 workers before sinking 2 days later on Earth Day. This isn't just a slow-motion ecological disaster, but is also becoming an economic disaster, paralyzing a region that supplies 40% of the U.S. domestic seafood market and one of the most productive fisheries in the world. Officials say the economic fallout could get worse, and this is if, only if, the oil spill gets into the Mississippi River Delta, where it could disrupt shipping traffic, a main shipping artery for the entire country. The president has ordered a halt to all new offshore permits until a full investigation into the accident is completed. In the meantime, federal authorities have instituted a commercial and recreational fishing ban in the area of the spill for the next 10 days, citing concerns over safety.
BP is responsible for this leak. BP will be paying the bill.
That was President Obama on Sunday after touring the massive oil spill in the Gulf, reassuring residents of the coast who are most impacted by the spill that BP will pay the costs of cleanup. But there's a catch. Economic damages after the cleanup is paid for, this is liability for lost wages and lost business due to the spill, that is legally capped at only $75 million. A new bill has been introduced in Congress yesterday to amend the law to raise that liability cap to $10 billion.
But it's my understanding that law won't take effect until the next spill, the next ecological disaster. We've got a mess on our hands, folks, and I'll ask again, where the hell is Obama and the Democrats calling for clean energy legislation now? If not now, when? Read more about that at our website, greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
I think it's time we stop, children. Watch that sound. Everybody look what's going down.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
This is a public service announcement.
There's a new type of music program coming to the Horn.
Got a letter from the government the other day. Opened it and read it. It said they were suckers.
They wanted me about a summer or whatever. Picture me buying the scam. I said never.
But I don't need the battle.
Music for liberals. Music for activists. Music with a social conscience.
Down K Street,
the People's Mixtape.
Johnny's dead and Mitch has gone. Kelly Halfway was out on the list. And then goes on and on.
Coming soon to the Head On Radio Network.
No. Cut your flag. The gal won't get you into heaven anymore.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're Head On with Bob Kincaid.
Yeah, and in 19 minutes, we'll be into the third hour. And so these things happen. Oh, well. But anyway, welcome back to the program. That was a fascinating conversation. I'm really glad we had it. And so much to go into in what remains of the program, hour and 19 minutes of it or so. So, you know, we will do our best to get to a jillion different things. Before I do go to the phones, just a quick update for you. You remember, what was it, Wednesday last, that we were talking about the what was it called? The Restoration of Stephen Baldwin. Remember the Restoration of Stephen Baldwin? Yeah, I don't think I mentioned this. Because God knows they don't mention this at restorestephenbaldwin.com. What the... Stephen Baldwin's debts in his bankruptcy? Yeah, $2.3 million worth of debt in his bankruptcy. Where does it come from? Well, it comes from mortgages, several mortgages. It comes from tax bills that he didn't pay. And it comes from credit cards that he maxed out. I some, you know, this is all based on the book of Job, and I somehow don't seem to recall any passages in Job talking about Job being a tax cheat or having several mortgages or maxing out his credit cards and going deadbeat on them. I don't remember any of that. No, sorry, don't. And I saw another news story today saying that every penny of the money given by the suckers, I mean faithful, will go straight to Stephen Baldwin. Isn't it beautiful? Whew. Wrong racket, Bob. Wrong racket. Let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob.
Hey, Sandra.
Oh, my God, that Baldwin thing. I mean, I saw a poster of it. What in the world?
Man, that's some brass.
Why can't he just get that money off his family? I mean, it's just...
Oh, maybe because his family's sick of his...
Yeah, no, no doubt. But it's just to hear that bit you played with that, I don't know, that preacher, whoever it was, who was soliciting. God, it was gross.
Yeah, it didn't do me any good. I had to take a scalding hot shower when I was done.
I was thinking about that conversation you had with, I'm sorry, I've forgotten her name.
Suzanne Gordon?
Yeah, I mean, I can't even wrap my head around the level of dedication to put up with what she was talking about. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'd be out the door in a minute.
You know, in the 12 hours, she made a great point. It's like, why do they need to work that shift? Just off the top, it's like they can't speak to anyone and they work 12. I mean, it's just sort of classic kind of woman's work. And you know what I mean? That.
Well, what's really frustrating about that, though, is that if you talk to a lot of folks in the nursing profession, they'll tell you they like those three 12-hour days or actually two 12-hour days and one 16-hour day.
And then they get
3 or 4 days off. They like that. But the human body is not set up for that.
Well, no, but I was just thinking about the. I mean, I've done a job for like short periods of time where I work 12-hour shifts, and trust me, after about 3 months of that, Bob, I don't care how many days off in a row you get. The first 2 days off, you're like in a daze.
Yeah, you're just getting well.
And by the time you recover, you have to go back to 12 hours. And so. It, you know, the days off are not really quality. But, and then with nursing, like she said, you have to use a lot of brain power and physical stamina and compassion all mixed together. Oh, my God.
I know. It's, the reason it was done that way, nurses were convinced that that was good for them. Oh, look, you'll have 4 days off. By management, and management did it to get nurses off the floor. So, you know, this is all penny pinching in the name of profits or bottom lines or some CEO's salary.
Yeah, and there never seems to be enough of, you know what I mean, enough in the profession either. Which is kind of it's intuitive hearing what the conditions are like. Good Lord, when she was talking about what young people have to, you know, I don't know, with that generation, I just don't see how...
And the crippling debt that goes with it?
Yeah, no, that was just a really eye-opening conversation, you know? It's kind of front lines, you know?
Yeah, and when you consider stuff like the infections that run through hospitals, I've got a statistic here that just blew my doors off, Sandra. Nurses suffer more musculoskeletal injuries on the job. Musculoskeletal injuries on the job than workers in mining and construction.
Is that? Wow. I mean, yeah, I really, God, that's incredible statistic.
And yet people, why we don't have more nurses? Jesus, they ought to be making $100,000-$125,000 a year. But again, we can't talk about stuff like that because, well, you know.
Oh, no. The discussion about wages is why they're not lower. That is the only conversation going on.
Yes.
And it's just really disturbing.
Why are we paying them so much?
Right, and of course, what you're told when you broach it is, well, you know, the employer can just turn around and say they're going to, you know, fill in a blank country. And so it's just a continuous race to the bottom. But, you know, my hand goes up and says, how do you sustain demand in that environment? Crickets, hello?
Yeah.
Crickets. Because, really, how do you...
They've got high suicide rates. Nurses under 30 surveyed say, I'm quitting next year.
It should be more in the profession and less hours and obviously more control over their job site. I can't believe how constrained it is. Wow.
Well, look, you know, physicians, you know, we have set up medical practitioners, physicians, MDs. We've set them up as God Almighty.
Well, no, they need to be outsourced too. Sorry, if we're going to, I mean, I'm sick of hearing about the outsource being just for the bottom, and I'm being facetious, but, you know, my economic professor will have to worry about it.
Yeah, no kidding. Dig this one, Sandra. By the year 2020, 10 years from, or 9.5 years from now, you know, God willing, the crick don't rise, we're both still around for that one. By 2020, 65% of the population will be 65 or older, and it is predicted that we will be short 700,000 nurses to care for them. Now, how are you going to get them educated in 9 years?
Well, no. I mean, I'm still stuck on a year. Yeah, that's right up, rolling right on us.
Yeah, be here in a minute.
Oh, no. Well, I just thought the conversation was really an eye-opener and just really disturbing because, like you said, the demand is going up for health care.
Well, why does this seem to be, and you always hear this about nursing, why does this seem to be the one place where the law of supply and demand doesn't obtain? I mean, obviously, there's high demand, low supply.
It's endless demand. I mean, it's just sort of, it's stunning. What you're getting is where nurses are trained, guess what? More cuts. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah. There's not just a nursing shortage, and I should have, because she's in the education realm, I didn't ask this question, but I think I know the answer. There's not just a nursing shortage, there's a nursing teacher shortage.
Yeah, oh, no, that's because at the university I'm at, that's like a, because it has a good nursing school, but that is a huge issue right now, is raising of the fees, you know, cutting classes, and then the professionals who teach it.
I think if I had one of those druthers situations where if the lights go out and everything and I have to quit doing this, I would be strongly tempted to go into, there's like an osteopath school about 2 hours from here. I'd be strongly tempted to do that, but then, you know, you turn me loose with one of those and I start feeling all Marcus Welby and the next thing, you know, I've run off to join the circus with Doctors Without Frontiers and I'm in Nigeria somewhere, you know, trying to fend off dengue fever.
Well, no, I mean, the health industry is expanding, but what it's expanding into is what's scary. I mean, I'm still stuck on the gag order. What in the world? That is just so...
Don't say anything that would demean the good reputation of the corporation.
Oh, no, it's just hideous. It makes me feel sick. Well, anyway, the other reason why I called was, I'm sorry, what's going on with the administration? It's just so quiet. Why aren't they using this opportunity to say, oh, shoot, snap, and then start talking about the green economy? Isn't this the best time?
You know, there's a lot of places I wish they weren't so quiet. You know, what I started off railing about at the top of the program, I want everything that the Obama administration does fixing or trying to fix or trying to prevent these disasters or return from the disasters, whether it be the Gulf Coast or Nashville or whatever. I want it to come, I want them all to come with a little caveat. You know, do not remove this label under prosecution, under penalty of law, that says this is happening because we have a constitution that says provide for the general welfare, and we're providing for the general welfares, and you bagger assholes need to shut up. Because, you know, when Alabama says, oh, please invoke title whatever it is and federalize the National Guard so they're not on Alabama's tab for the mess that BP, Halliburton, and Horizon or whomever created, you know, that just makes me want to run screaming naked around the room. Oh, you want us to federalize the National Guard so Alabama doesn't have to pay for it. But that is a state that is chock-a-block with baggers and birthers and deathers. But suddenly you want some of that socialism money.
Well, I'm just sort of stunned at the sort of legal protection that these transnational corporations enjoy. Am I to understand that there's like a limit on what they can pay out for a disaster like this?
Yeah, I saw that not too long back. What? The top end is like $75 million for BP?
After the cleanup. But the thing is that, and there's some sort of general oil spill fund that the government runs. But, I mean, it's just stunning. This company should be dismantled and put to death.
Yes.
It should be done after this. I mean, do they even have a clue as how they're going to cap this? Are we looking at some sort of...
No, because what they've done is instead of capping, they have started drilling the relief well.
Well, yeah, because they don't want to cap it because they still want to get at that shit. Ain't that what's going on?
I think that's a part of it. Oh, well, I can't just leave it down there. But there's some stuff out there I read today that the well was... same story. It's whether it's Massey mining coal or somebody drilling oil. The regulations say you can do this, but we're having voluntary compliance month. You can only have one cupcake, and you know there's the oil executive with six on his plate. No, the thing was apparently it was approved for 19,000 feet, and instead they drilled to 25.
Oh, of course, yeah. No, I mean all of it is. But the thing is that. That looks like something that will be decades before it's right, and then lost species forever, right? I mean, this is a huge catastrophe.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Meanwhile, Rick Goodhair Perry, governor of Texas, has officially blamed Almighty God.
You know, I saw that. It just is depressing. It really is. Isn't it starting to whip up east now, though?
It may. If it gets picked up in the Gulf Stream, it goes east. It goes around the Florida Keys and up the East Coast.
Well, you know what? How about we mix in a Category 4 so that shit can be, washed totally on land? I mean, the possibilities...
Well, it is hurricane season, Sandra.
That's what I'm saying. And so, you know, the possibilities are just... It's all a nightmare, And if it wasn't so serious, it would be just laughable that Obama was out on March 31st talking about expanding it. You know what I mean? I'm like, dude, is there a lesson learned here yet?
And yet, by the same token, he doesn't, you know, he doesn't feel comfortable saying anything more than, well, you know, we're not going to do this again until we're sure why we did it the first time.
Noah Arnold came out swinging.
Yeah, look at Arnold. I mean, that was, yeah.
That's because these idiots had lost their minds thinking about doing something off of Santa Barbara, and it's like, hello, freaks.
You know what drives me a little bit nuts, though, Sandra? I play at this from time to time, but it's only because I'm exposed to how these sickos think and the way what passes for their minds work. You know, it wasn't a week and a half ago that I said, hey, look, anybody want to take odds on, and this is before anything got said, before the first peep, anybody want to take odds on this turning into a conspiracy theory that the liberals done it? And bang, there it is. Brad and Desi played it during their Green News update. Rush Limbaugh out there saying the environmental wackos done it.
Oh, yeah. No, I know. I mean, it's just sort of, it's just stunning. I'm not too sure I'm understanding the spin, because them people down there looking at it, I don't think Rush's words are going to soothe that. I think he has to be done, right?
No, that's the thing, because it's those 20%ers. It's not the 3%ers, you know, that weirdo from Alabama. It's the 20%ers. It's because 20% of the people in this country, Sandra, are dead-enders because they believe crazy crap. They believe insane things like the Obama administration deliberately let the well leak.
Oh, right. Oh, I mean, no, it's just so much BS and so absurd. But, I mean, so you're suggesting that the stuff is put out by these freaks and their followers lap it up. Is this what the worry is?
Like kittens on a dish of cream. I mean, look, maybe it's more than 20%. There's a poll out. And this, granted, it's not the same topic, but I think these things have a certain degree of transferability. New York Times CBS poll says, one, the public broadly agrees that the Arizona the police state law will result in racial profiling. Okay, they agree. But 51% say that the law itself is about right.
Oh, yeah, no.
And another 9% say it doesn't go far enough.
Right, no, that was another thing that I saw that really was just, I was just shaking my head thinking, this place is really, I think I was taking a nap and I thought, I got to get out of here. This is what crossed my mind before I drifted off. Because I saw that poll, too, and I'm just sort of like, wow. But on the other hand, can you please tell me why these attempted terrorist attacks are being treated as if something actually happened? Do you understand that, what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well, you mean as opposed to we stopped this thing and therefore
yeah.
We're getting the job done?
Yeah, it just feels like the way it's going on, you would think that it actually blew, or that plane blew up in the sky during Christmas. You see what I mean? The way it's...
Yeah, it's not... Right. The Obama administration is not keeping us safe because they tried and failed, because the terrorists tried and failed.
Right.
Excuse me. For 8 years, we had to listen to George W. Bush kept us safe because the terrorists tried and succeeded.
Right. So, I mean, I just was sort of thinking about that, thinking, oh, my God, everything is so ass backwards. And, you know, the New York Times is just covered with this story nonstop. And it's like, okay, I understand it was, you know, kind of frightening or could have gone down. And they've caught people, right?
Caught dude. And this is kind of interesting. Not on a plane to Iraq. Not on a plane to Saudi Arabia, certainly not on a plane to Pakistan. Dude was on a plane to Dubai.
Oh.
You know, George Bush's best friends. But he was, maybe it's because Dubai and doofus both start with the same sound, duh. Because this guy, let's see, he didn't have his propane tanks open. And instead of having ammonium nitrate fertilizer a la right-wing terrorist Timothy McVeigh, he had a bag of, you know, Scott's Turf Builder or whatever. Didn't even have the right fertilizer.
And there was a cigarette lit in the ashtray. Were they planning on just letting that and thought it would catch the air or something? I was like, what? It was, you know, the cigarette had me going. I thought, oh, come on. And they're saying on NPR, oh, maybe they'll be able to get, you know, DNA evidence from that. And it's just like...
Yeah, because a little hunk of his lip hung on the filter tip of the cigarette.
Well, it was just sort of the breathless reporting, you know what I'm saying? And from NPR, so it's just, God knows what's happening on Fox. Like, I can't drift much further than NPR, you see, these days. Fox, MSA, all of that. I'm just over it. I just listened to your show.
Well, bless your heart. You know, if nothing, we'll all go crazy together.
Oh, Lord. Listen, I'll let you go. I just, you know, wanted to check in.
All right. Take care, Sandra.
All right. Bye.
Bye now. And You know, I joke about the tattered purple robe with the frayed moon and stars on it. But after a while, you begin to feel a little bit special or something. But there's nothing special to it. This is, I've been listening to right-wing speak for longer than I can remember. I used to listen to it all the time, like I'd work weekends at the Gospel Voice. And there was always some right-wing preacher on that we had to put the little cassette in the cassette tape deck that was wired into the radio board and play. And you couldn't help but hear some of it. And that's how far back it goes, because that crap plays in a place, in places like the Deep South. On the other hand, however, I would like to point out to you, I got a little piece of audio here for you. The Heritage Foundation, you know, the one, the right wing so-called think tank, the stink tank that has more money than God Almighty himself. The Heritage Foundation hosted a national security conference featuring a guy who couldn't actually stay on the job but had to bolt for a Britney Spears concert. Yes, House Minority Whip Eric Cantor of Virginia. And he took questions. And I want you to hear, I don't care about the answer. Actually, Eric Cantor did his dead level best to give something approaching a normal answer. But I want you to hear the guy, okay? I want you to hear the guy that asked the question.
I want to thank you for coming today. I realize this you come a great cause. And I thank you for your passion and your enthusiasm for this country. My question is... And this is something that I personally don't understand. If it's a naive question, then I apologize. But how, in light of what Obama has done,
Obama,
to leave us vulnerable, to cut defense spending, to make us vulnerable to our outside enemies, and to slight our allies, how... Let's see. What would he have to do differently to be defined as a domestic enemy?
Listen.
Now, Eric Cantor says, listen, let me respond very forthright to that. You know, no one thinks the president is a domestic enemy. Wrong, Eric Cantor, because... Dude there that asked the question very clearly does. And you'll notice that that was not some the moonshine-flavored redneck accent either. Obama? Mm-mm. No. That wasn't from south of the Mason-Dixie line. It's not like... You know, for all I harp on the east of Boga, Alabama, and you know, the right wing freaks down there, they do not have the franchise on it, not by any stretch of the imagination. That's what we would call what you heard. That's what we would call a potential homegrown terrorist. That up east Obama saying kind of guy. That's why, you know, that's why some of this isn't so easy. It's easy to talk about the nut jobs in places like the Deep South. My God, there's a Democrat named Gene Taylor, supposedly a Democrat named Gene Taylor from Mississippi, and this guy described the oil slick on the Gulf of Mexico from the blowout, the manifest negligence, the gross recklessness, the willful, wanton disregard for the proper running of that oil platform. He described it as chocolate milk. Mm-mm. It ain't always Republicans, and it ain't always Southerners. Nobody's ever going to accuse dude there at the Heritage Foundation from just getting done with his grits. No, no. No, no. It's a broader problem. That's what that 60% number means. 60% of the United States of America, according to a scientific survey, acknowledged that racial profiling will be an upshot of the police state immigration law in Arizona, but they're okay with it. They want racial profiling. And for a significant number of them, they would like for the racial profiling, like the guy at the Heritage Foundation, to start with that one in the White House. Gee, money. Let's see if I've got John Fox on the line. Do I have John Fox on the line?
Hey, go on, Bob.
Hey, what's up, John?
Not much. Boy, that was.
Yeah, well, I mean, only if not. Yeah, only if not much means you.
Okay, coming from via the webcam mic here.
Yeah, you're a little crispy crittery, but you know we'll get by.
Okay, I'll back off a bit. Is that better?
Yeah, some.
Okay. Anyway, big doings over the weekend, and as everyone knows, the website had been kind of buggy for a while. And, you know, you end up in these situations where you think, oh, I'll find this, and I'll fix that, and I'll find this, and I'll fix that. And you finally realize that something actually is inherently wrong with the engine, which we finally came to the decision that we had to pull it all down and rebuild from scratch, which is fine, and it's all going well. I'm really happy with the way things are going. However, what people need to know is that user accounts are not all restored yet. They will be restored over the next few days. This is part of the data problems that we were having, and the reasons are so lengthy I couldn't even possibly go into it. However, in the meantime, folks whose usernames aren't working at the moment, you can log in with your Facebook details. And once I get your Horn account restored, it will sync, as long as you use the same email address, it will sync your old data once we get that all restored in there with the Facebook. Don't worry about signing up for a new username on the Horn blog as of yet. And hopefully in the next few days, everything should be fully restored, but you should be able to get into the website with your Facebook details. Right now, we only have a handful of our bloggers with access to things otherwise at the moment as we, you know, get things happening. But it's such a massive improvement from where we were just a week ago.
Without a doubt, true. And I think you probably sold yourself a little bit short, John, in terms of what it's actually meant on your end. This has been huge. There's no quick fix to this kind of stuff. But one of the nice things is, this is a credit to the people who, the listeners who make sure that we keep going. What we had been using with the Horn's webpage was, for all intents and purposes, freeware and free theming. And at your recommendation, we finally sort of bit the bullet and paid for a theme that has some support to it and some follow-up and some background so that you can actually solve problems when they come up as opposed to just sort of blindly trying to sort it out all by yourself.
Well, yeah, because, you know, in the modern world of these content management systems, pretty much it all comes down to whatever system you're using. What makes it yours is the skin on it and what you have in that skin. And, you know, that can get to be a really complex thing, and we have gone with some themes written by the folks at Woo Themes, which have been developing their framework for probably almost as long as WordPress has existed. And it's a really, really great framework. In fact, the theme that we were using on the previous site actually was one of Woo's free themes, but the problems were not because of Woo. The problems were, had more to stem from about a year or so ago when we had to move servers. Some of Ben's servers that have been online for so long hit end of life. And when we migrated, something went a bit weird in the data tables. And we've never been able to quite rectify it.
Yeah, that's that the complex technical term, went sideways.
Yeah, really. I usually go went pear-shaped. So it came down to a situation. We've known this for a few months that it had to be a rebuild from scratch. There was no actual repairing. And so now, in piecemeal, I'm getting the data back up, the individual blogs that existed back up. The menuing is already so much clearer on this. In fact, I've gone and gotten all of the free Woo themes as well for our bloggers to choose from, just because the framework's really good. On the other one, since it was unsupported, all the hacking that I did to it to make it work with our social networking system, I did completely blind on my own, on a theme that I technically shouldn't have been able to do it on. And that was fine. It was other problems in the actual engine that were making everything very, very strange, where some things wouldn't work in Internet Explorer, but they work in every other browser. But hey, that's kind of a constant thing, even when it's written right. But we're getting there. We're getting there. And I think it's going to be a much more seamless user experience. Show posts from the show blogs will end up on the front page very easily, very readily. We'll get all the functionality. When we first tried to do the social networking thing, that's all really coming good now. And again, it's also one of those things, Bob, like you were talking, it's open source software, but even more than that, the whole social networking part of it was a development in progress with the community. And, sometimes when you're on the cutting edge, you fall off.
You get cut.
Yeah. So that's where we are. So folks can log in to comment and stuff via their Facebook details at the moment. Just be patient. At some stage, you log in and suddenly you'll see all your old activity pop up in most cases. The forum hasn't been touched yet since it was kind of standing and running on its own. That should still be standing and running on its own. It will end up being tied in like it was always intended to into the rest of the site so that people can create groups and have group forums and some other things that were always in the works, but the broken engine got in the way.
Well, exactly, and having the thing up and fully functioning, as I mentioned at the top of the program, has a lot to do with wanting to put our best foot forward. We're hoping that a lot of people will see the page with the appearances that we're doing more and more out there. And this is a huge step, and I tell you, you have my personal thanks, and I'm quite certain the thanks of the Horn family for the time that this has taken you and the time it continues to take.
Well, sometimes with these things, Bob, the hardest thing is trying to actually just block out enough of a block of time to take something like this on. And as everyone who might try to listen to my program would know, I've been a bit all over the shop lately, and getting blocks of time has been difficult, but you and I had some discussions last week where we decided, Netroots Nation is coming up. We got to get it sorted. We got to get it back up and get our presence looking right. And so, you know, there we are. And I'm really happy with the way it's going. Things are still going to shift around. You know, the show blogs haven't even been themed yet, aside from yours, just a touch. And it's all kind of in a priority of as we get there. But, you know, if everybody can be patient, chat logins are always as they were. They're separate from the Horn blog system. And nothing about the chat room should have changed. You should be able to log in just as you did. If anybody has any issues with their logins, they can email me, John, J-O-N, at headonradionetwork.com. We're getting there, and I hope, you know.
And another thing worth mentioning, this is a big step forward on what eventually we hope to do with some more video related aspects to it.
Yeah, and we're looking into different ways to incorporate and archive video content, and you know that'll be coming down the pipe as well. Right now, it's really working on restoring all that data, whether I can get old images and media to actually restore on the main blog. That seems to be one of the major things that got totally screwed up in the old one. But that's where we are. There's going to be a lot more functionality. One of the things we're going to tie much more into Facebook than we ever did. There's some development stuff. Right now, we just have the ability to log in via Facebook details. Down the pipe, your activities on your Horn blog or group can be ported to your Facebook page and some other things like that. That's all still in development with Andy Peatling over at Buddy Press. But it's looking really, really good. and this is one of those things, man, why I love open source so much. A lot of what we're using would not have happened at the rate that it's happened if it weren't for people that build stuff just because they want to see it be able to be done, not necessarily that they need to see a buck for it straight away. And that's one of the great things about the internet, and we got to try and take advantage of that as best we can, as you know.
We absolutely do, because there's a lot about what we do that's kind of got an open source flavor of its own to it.
Absolutely. So we're getting there. Nobody's locked out. That's one thing that I gotta put out there. You know, I've got a couple of emails. I can't get in. It's just kind of like right now the shop's not fully open because we're still taking inventory. Your keys will be restored. Your temporary keys are your Facebook details. But aside from that, Bob, hopefully over the next week we should be virtually all up and running, and then the additional stuff like the video contents and whatnot will come down the pipe as we work it in. And the last thing that I want to put up is just a totally shameless plug. Any of the Horn listeners that are in New South Wales here in Australia, and I know we have a few, the kids of Swivelhead have a gig the 22nd of May, Saturday, at the Sandringham Hotel. If you're interested in getting tickets, we got a 2-for-1 deal going. Go to swivelhead.com.au and you can buy your tickets in advance, and love to see some of the Horn listeners at the show. Like, I've already, you know, seen Angry and a couple of other people down there.
Oh, I think that would be very cool. And in fact, you have kindly provided me some audio to play you out. You know what that means, don't you?
The opening track from the Swivelhead album, Cannot Live Here. This is usually the set opener, and I love this song. I love this band, not just because they're my friends, but they're great players.
They are. They're intensely good. They're intensely proficient musicians, among other things. But see, I can't see a line like "Play Me Out" without what does that mean? To play me out.
You're going to have an O'Reilly moment, aren't you?
We'll do it live. We'll do it live.
So anyway, before I go, I know you've made this point a couple times on air. At the moment, my show is on temporary hiatus as we deal with some of these technical things, and as I figure out when I can do my show regularly, because, well, my work life has changed dramatically over the last couple of months. And so we're going to figure that all out, and I just really think it was unfair to my listeners to constantly be, is he on? Is he not? Is he on? Is he not? So until we kind of get through all this technical brouhaha, and I kind of figure out where and when I can do it regularly, Foxed Up will be back as soon as we can.
Right. As soon as practicable.
Yes.
All right. Well, John, thanks a million, brother.
No worries, man. Have a great show. Thanks very much. We'll talk to you later.
All right. We'll talk to you soon, brother.
All right. Bye.
Bye now. And that is John Fox. What isn't John Fox to the horn? Chief engineer, webmaster, web designer, technical innovator, and show host. That last on hiatus ever so briefly. But as John did mention, yes, we have a track to play him out. So we'll run this Cannot Live Here from Swivelhead. And, yeah, if you're down somewhere around New South Wales, go check them out. Right here, only on America's listener-supported liberal voice, The Horn. We'll do it live in a minute. There we go.
I'm not the end of my road, but it can't live here. We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95?
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
The wind, you feel it fresh in your face. That wind can change the world, and that change begins in Appalachia. Go to coalriverwind.org. Coal companies bombing Appalachia must be stopped. You can do that. We can change America with the Coal River Wind Project. We can't do it without you. coalriverwind.org. Go there for yourself, for our future. coalriverwind.org.
Left in the program here this Tuesday night. Feels like my Monday, but I'm trying to get over it. You know the number, 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on, or on your nickel, 304-658-3333, and we'll try to get some conversation in for the remainder of the program. A couple of quick emails before we go to the phones. Assuming there's still someone there. William writes in and he says, you know, one would think using common sense that these things alone, all the massive horrors just in the last few weeks alone, that these things would shock the people of the U.S. into a true state of reality where we would all work together for a goal so we could all live rather than allowing the insane wedge issues to keep us dumbed down and divided where we will never get out of this. Instead, we continue to create sacrifice for gain as a path to nowhere, and call it some sort of normal act. I know. And the reason for that? Well, look, it's fairly simple. Look at the bagger and his, what does it take? What does it take before we can call Obama an enemy of the people? You know, that thinking doesn't come out of thin air. Not by a long shot, it doesn't. Neither does the incessant, already ginned-up, right-wing screech that Faisal Shahzad be denied his Miranda rights and just torture him instead. Of course, you know, we know where these things... They're ginned up inside the Republican right-wing think-tank consortium, whether it's the American Enterprise Institute or the Heritage Foundation or any one of a number of these right-wing filth generators. And they are used to keep a scarable populace perpetually terrified, whether it be of Mexicans, so to speak, of environmentalist wackos, or that brown man in the White House. Ooh, scary stuff. On another note, got an email in from Diane, designer of the inimitable once-in-a-lifetime for the love of West Virginia prints. Still available, by the way. Your kind contribution of $75 with things kind of down on the website right now. Just shoot me an email, bobkincaid@gmail.com. and tell me or make your PayPal contribution and say, I want a print, $75, get you one. They are becoming scarcer and scarcer and scarcer. Diane was the designer and the creator of those lovely, lovely pieces, and she sent me a link a few minutes ago. And it is to a story that says, Brooklyn artists, this is a New York City-based story, Brooklyn artists barter for your next physical exam. Diane saying, not really sure how I feel about this, but it brings to mind a circular pattern. And basically, you know, bartering, upgrading from chickens to artists. Yeah. And you go and you read the news story and you find out that Woodhull Hospital in New York City, in Brooklyn, has a program whereby they trade for every hour of art, music, dance, or any other artistic service you give to Woodhull Hospital, you get 40 health credits toward medical care there. Each credit's worth $1, so 1 hour equals $40 worth of medical care. Wow. And yeah, I understand the impulse behind it, but I also understand Diane when she says it, you know, it looks a little like upgrading from chickens to artists. And that they're operating on the same barter plane of worth. But Diane does note it sort of brings to mind a circular pattern. A dancer gets hurt in practice and needs to get x-rays. So the dancer has to teach people how to dance for at least an hour to have a doctor look at her or him, only to be told the x-rays will cost 8 hours of extra dance classes, and she can't teach or he can't teach because of the injury in the first place and therefore have no bartering power. And Diane asks, then this is supposed to work just how again? Oh, God, wouldn't it be simpler if we just had universal single-payer health care that took care of dancers and dentists and everybody in between? Yeah. But our betters are apparently doing okay. News breaking from the New York Times that a Picasso that was executed by the master in less than a day, called Nu au Plateau de Sculpteur, nude, green leaves, and sculpture, from March 1932, has just sold at auction at Christie's for $106.5 million. Mind-boggling. Just mind-boggling. To the phones we do go. Hey, welcome to the program.
How do you follow John Fox?
Indeed. What's up, dude?
Not much. I did want to mention, I don't know if you, did you mention what closed Friday? I thought the topic would come up during the, your subject with the nurse because it is relevant.
No.
St. Vincent's Hospital closed Friday.
For good?
Yep. 3,600 employees. Out.
Goodbye. Yeah.
Bye. They said they couldn't come up with the funds. I tend to think that's bullshit.
That
open since the 1840s.
A New York City institution, to say the least. That's just, wow. 160-year-old hospital in Greenwich Village.
Right.
So where do they go?
You know, they say they're going to...
Where do the ER cases go? Where do
They use keywords like transfer and shift around and words to that usage. But to me, I don't care. There's going to be so many people who lose out on that just because someone couldn't properly fund the hospital. You could have got Goldman Sachs to fund it. That could have been part of their punishment.
Eileen Dunn, according to the Associated Press story, Eileen Dunn, a St. Vincent's nurse of 24 years,
yeah,
said, I have no job. I am unemployed. It's over. It's like a funeral inside. Most of us have been here for many years.
Yep. You see, but the problem, see, the problem is that it really does someone could have put together a fundraiser and helped save that hospital. It's a question of why didn't they that comes to mind. And the people of New York, a lot of the philanthropists probably knew for a long time that St. Vincent's was on its way out. And it again, I don't think you look at the buildings in New York that constantly remain open, the ones that get the bailouts, the ones that don't. I don't understand. It's the same conversation. It's like a 360 degrees of what we were talking about when I told you about that Philadelphia library.
Yeah, that's it. I was thinking about the very same thing, David. You know, but apparently, I mean, why didn't one of the big for-profit hospital chains purchase it? I mean, I don't think. I mean, is there an argument to be made that in New York City there are too many outlets for health care?
Well, you know, here's the thing that I don't get. Any of those billionaires in New York who are constantly trying to pat themselves on the back, where the hell were they? You mean to tell me Warren Buffett couldn't raise the funds for that? Okay. You mean to tell me Bloomberg? It's a New York institution. You get the press. You get the publicity. It's a win-win situation. Yet there's a disconnect here.
I don't know. I don't have enough details I mean, was it in trouble in terms of services rendered? Was it rendering poor services? I mean, but no, it was fully staffed, wasn't it?
It was the hospital. See, here's the problem. The hospital was fully staffed. They were fine. It's just that, you know, when you come along a bump in the road.
You know what I got to ask is what's going on the property? Once they demolish it, what goes up? And therein, David, will lie your answer. And that's just, you know, my paranoid hillbilly response. You know, what I need is a hardcore New Yorker to tell me why it closed.
Probably a financial firm.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, I mean
well, you say, okay, so you see where my mind is going.
But again, I mean, I'm still kind of stunned at the fact that no one stepped up in the billionaire Wall Street sector who always try to pat themselves on the back. We saved the New York institution. No, they didn't do it. This hospital has been around since the Titanic.
Yeah, but you know, it's Greenwich Village, and you know what kind of people live in Greenwich Village, and
they would. I mean. I'm guessing if it was a different time period, would the results be different? I'm guessing it would be. Like if this happened in the 1970s or the 1960s.
Or, I don't know. Had it faced financial difficulties and had to be hauled out of the fire before? I simply don't know.
I don't know. The other thing I wanted to briefly touch on was the whole New Orleans oil rig disaster.
Yeah.
But I wanted to mention to people that there's a great new show on HBO. Everyone should watch it. And Bob, I do mean you should watch it.
Well, not a prayer. Me no got no HBO.
Oh, don't worry, Bob. I got you on that one.
Oh, okay.
It's the show is called Tremé, and it's about a neighborhood in New Orleans, and it's from the creators of The Wire and what makes it unique.
Oh man, I've heard about this one. Yeah.
This is an impressive show. Just for starters.
You had to say Wire before I made the connection.
Yeah. Just for starters, I mean, you talk about who to expect for guests. I mean, they pack this with John Goodman does an amazing job as a teacher on it. Amazing job. If he doesn't get an Emmy, there's something wrong. But, I mean, in one episode, I'll give you guys an idea. One episode, they have a studio session with Dr. John. Another episode, they have guest starring Alan Toussaint and Elvis Costello. So this is an idea of the musical guests that they put on every week. And great storylines. People who watch The Wire already know an amazing cast and really does a great service to New Orleans and does not try to sugarcoat it. And the great thing about it is the people who put it together understand this. Most of the media always tries to focus on New Orleans, a city that has fallen from grace. And that show doesn't do that. What this show does is this show shows you that it's still alive, that it still has its heartbeat, and it shows you the businesses that are trying to kickstart and get back into action.
Well, you know, David, by mentioning TV, you took me to a different place.
Right.
And I also sort of juxtaposed this over against the email that William sent a couple of minutes ago that I just read.
Right.
You want to know why we can't fix what's broken? I got an example of why right here. I get blast emails from publicity flacks from a TV show called Extra. I have never seen it.
Oh, God. I hate that show.
But Extra, I have to credit Extra with this, or I don't know. Yeah. They'll send the PR secret police after me and take me to Arizona or something.
Mm-hmm.
Please feel free to use the story below with a proper link and credit to Extra. Hills stars at odds over Montag's accusations. Extra's Lauren Sanchez sat down with the Hills stars, Brody Jenner, Audrina Partridge, and Kristen Cavallari, who responded to accusations that executive producer Adam DiViello had been inappropriate with Heidi Montag.
Wow.
Really? Really? And they're spending how much money to let people know this? And I just fell for it, but I did so as part of a larger point of who gives a... But you know what? You know what? You know who gives a...
Yeah.
A whole lot of people measured in millions, David.
I know. Millions.
I mean, these are some reasonably pleasant-looking human beings. I mean, we've got apparently Brody Jenner, and Audrina Partridge is certainly appealing to look at, and so is Kristen Cavallari.
I got one for you.
And so why do I care?
I got one to show you exactly. It's coming from a news organization. Michelle Obama sends out her first tweet. I looked at it and I was like, wait a minute. You know, usually these statements, they don't go into like detail. This one is like 10 paragraphs. And what was great about it was the comment section. Like, this is news? Obama sends out her first tweet.
Yeah, meanwhile, here's another one for you.
Yeah.
The New York Times put out a fair and balanced report on why the platform explosion disaster blowout might not be quite so bad. And Brad Friedman is breaking this, and he writes over at bradblog.com, in a May 3rd New York Times editorial, Drilling Disaster in Denial, Paul Krugman points to a Gallup poll which found Americans are now less worried about a series of environmental problems. And, you know, Drilling Disaster in Denial is a brilliant, brilliant column. So the New York Times gets a news story out about the disaster, about the explosion, only there's one problem. In the front page news analysis that the New York Times offers, David, guess what?
What's that?
They offer a scientific expert to help support the thesis that the Deepwater Horizon blowout was not unprecedented, nor is it yet among the worst oil accidents in history. That's their thesis. And so they go and find an expert to say that. The expert says, and the expert's name is Quentin R. Dokken, D-O-K-K-E-N, apparently no relation to the former metal band.
Yeah.
Quentin R. Dokken says, the sky is not falling. And they identify him as a marine biologist and executive director of the Gulf of Mexico Foundation, a conservation group in Corpus Christi, Texas. We've certainly stepped in a hole, and we're going to have to work ourselves out of it, but it isn't the end of the Gulf of Mexico. But guess, as Brad Friedman points out, guess what the New York Times doesn't do?
What's that?
They don't tell anybody that Mr. Dawkins' conservation group, the Gulf of Mexico Foundation, here's the punchline, is sponsored in large part by the offshore drilling industry.
You know,
I remember when they used to teach these classes called journalism ethics in school.
You know, I was reading some of the inside information on the oil rig disaster, and one of the things they said that really interested me and probably will interest some of the listeners is the fact of how much the culture of oil rig and engineer and knowing your education has changed so much. And basically, from what I was getting at, the details of what this guy was who worked on one of these similar oil rigs, he said, the culture has changed so much that nobody reads manuals, nobody reads the books, and they take pride in it.
Well, the books are probably written by English as a second language offshore translators and God knows where. Wow, that was really mean of me, but, you know, I'd have an element of truth. And, you know, here's more fun.
Yeah.
Of the Gulf of Mexico Foundation's board of directors, 19 members have direct ties to the offshore drilling industry. Here's a hoot. One of the board of directors members is actually currently an executive at Transocean. Mm. And that's the company that owns Deepwater Horizon. Nah, we wouldn't want to disclose that to readers or nothing on the national paper of record or anything, now would we? Heck no. Hey, David, I got to roll along. Awful good to hear from you, though.
All right, before I go, everybody check out the show Treme on HBO.
And we spell that how?
Treme.
Good deal. Thanks, David.
All right, later.
Bye now. Pop culture correspondent David calling from Maine. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob?
Yes. Hey, Jim.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing good.
Well, as far as St. Vincent's is concerned, they filed for bankruptcy last month, and they were like $1 billion in the hole.
And that's quick. Why not restore St. Vincent's Hospital instead of restoring Stephen Baldwin?
Well, I totally agree with you, but
sorry,
I understand. I was totally floored by that, but the transfer of function will be from St. Vincent's to Bellevue.
Oh, because they're not overcrowded or anything.
No. And St. Vincent's, of course, is a Catholic-affiliated hospital. And I'm sure that there's got to be some connection between the church and the closing of that hospital. Plus two other factors. Number one, returning on investment, and number two, real estate value.
Yeah, because when I said, what'll it be once it's not a hospital anymore, Lottie in the chat room immediately chimed in and said, condos. It'll be condos.
Oh, Trump Tower number 19 probably, right?
Yeah. Lottie said, usually hospitals close and condos go up. He said Winthrop Hospital was made directly into condos.
And I would assume that part of the city, you have a lot of ER things that come in there. And, of course, by federal law, hospitals, whether you have the money or not, have to treat ER. And, you know.
Yeah, they treat to the point of stability. They have to stabilize them, yeah.
Right. And that has a lot to do with it. But, you know, I had heard from friends in New York that that was going to happen. But I'd hoped against hope until hope. Obviously, last Friday became hope abandoned. And well, that's a very, very sad, sad thing. I mean, what's next, Sloan Kettering?
You got to wonder. You really do, Jim.
Well, I had originally rung you up to remind you that it is National Public Servants Week.
Is it really?
Yeah, it is. And, you know, for federal, state, local, county, whatever, all the people who keep things running for us. And I was just going to say a few words about public servants. And
do please.
And what? Well, I just don't have any. I'm just kind of floored right now. I mean, I think I've said enough about public service on this program that I don't have to say any more other than without them, where the hell would we be? But, you know, what your last caller said about St. Vincent's, I mean, they have enough billionaires in that town to have more or less accommodated the needs of that hospital until they could stabilize it. But they didn't want to.
And you can almost hear the conversation over the hummingbird tongue canapes, can't you, Jim? Well, my God, do you realize the real estate value that that's sitting on? What we could do with that?
Well, I can guarantee you they did not do this without the consent of the Vatican and also the financial moguls who stand to gain from.
Yeah, well, you know, the Archdiocese of New York would have some say-so in it, would it not?
They would. But, you know, this is strangely enough. I had one good Roman Catholic tell me that the bishops, because of certain abortion practices or attitudes in the Catholic hospitals, that the bishops ought to just close them down.
I actually heard on NPR a couple of weeks back a discussion along those lines about the kerfuffle that has been started inside Roman Catholic healthcare facilities about how they square up what they refer to as the church's teaching. You know, they never say what the Bible says. The church's teaching.
It's always the church's teaching and how they interpret things.
Yeah, versus what the law requires. And you know, and of course, you know what was done in Washington D.C. Catholic Charities in Washington D.C. took up, simply because gay people can get married in Washington D.C. They stopped offering health care to all spouses.
I brought that up earlier on this program, remember?
Yeah. And not only that, for the same reason, they threw some 70 or 80, I think, foster children off on other agencies.
Absolutely.
Can't beat it. You can't beat that following the Prince of Peace, can you?
Not the Prince of Peace, but the Papal Curia and the organization of the Catholic Church, and I guess they're going to probably have to take some of the money they get from that, if the Catholic Church is going to gain any money from it, to pay for some of these losses they've sustained over the lawsuits over the years, and they're going to continue.
Yeah, brought about by rape.
Exactly. That really floored me.
Well, and that's what Lottie is saying in the chat room right now. St. Vincent's was sacrificed to pay for the fling with the altar boys. Now it makes sense.
Well, that's the way I perceive it, and I hate to look at things that way. I really do, but I don't know how else to look at it. Do you?
You're kind of hard-pressed to do otherwise, Jim.
Well, on that note, I'm going to leave you, and I wish you and your spouse a happy 17th anniversary, and I sent you an email to that effect. So you.
I saw it. Thank you very kindly, and I'll show it to Agnes.
Okay, you take care.
Take care, Jim. Bye now. And let's see if we can get one more caller in. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, it's Kevin from Seoul.
Hey, what's up, Kevin? Good morning.
I'll tell you what this is. They're not even going to knock down the building. They're just going to gut it out and turn it into a condo.
Man, lots of money there.
They're doing it about my neighborhood in Brooklyn. Brooklyn Jewish Hospital, which was there, they turned it into a condo when they closed it down.
And the condos are probably about the size of a hospital room, aren't they?
Well, hey, you know, they're going to flip it. You know, classic flip this house scenario, but it's flip this house for billionaires.
Jeez. Yeah, I kind of wish I was still blissfully ignorant wondering why these things happen.
But, you know, they're not even going to knock down the building. They're going to gut it out, probably, and put in a few condos, put a health spa in there, you know.
Maybe a little internet cafe on the first floor.
Exactly. A couple of Starbucks on the ground floor, or Starbucks-like places, probably a pool and tennis court on top and a golf putting range.
Yeah, because Greenwich Village is, you know, nice real estate, huh?
Yeah, it's pretty hot now. No, banking house is going to go there, but the bankers will be living there.
Yeah. No kidding. Maybe some $15,000 shower curtains and solid gold-plated shower fixtures and a $30,000 umbrella stand. Sheesh.
Yeah. I'm telling you, that's what they're going to do. I don't even think they're going to knock down the building.
Pro-anti in the chat room, Kevin, has a lovely thought. He said, tiled floors, free flesh-eating disease. Wonder how long it'll take them to get rid of that. Maybe some of it can stick around for some Wall Street bankers. Hey, why is my flesh melting?
Yeah.
And there'll be another Wall Street banker standing next to him from Goldman Sachs saying, "I'll go short that you're dead by tomorrow."
But you know what's so sad though? St. Vincent's is not an attractive building. It's like one of these Logan's Run like monstrosities, you know. At least what they did around my way in Brooklyn Jewish, at least the hospital was an older building which had kind of character to it.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But this is just a big red square.
Brick?
This is
made with original brick for the 19th century. It was vintage brick.
Yeah, it looks like something out of...
I mean, my God, this hospital treated survivors of the Titanic and cholera outbreak. When was the last New York City cholera outbreak? They were treated at St. Vincent's.
1800s, I think.
Oh, my God. Hey, Kevin, I hate to say it, but I gotta roll along, brother.
Okay, bro.
Good hearing from you. Take care.
Okay, bye.
Bye now. Calling from South Korea, formerly of Brooklyn, that is Kevin. With a little more insight on why and how a St. Vincent's goes away. So that's the program. Thanks, everybody, for your patience dealing with the website. And thanks for your continued kindness helping us keep all of this going and on the air. Thanks to everybody who makes it go and makes it work. Thanks to Lottie, our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thanks to our blogger, Texas Betsy. Thanks to John Fox, to Peter Godbold, to Ben Birch at WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks to our Southeast correspondent, Matt Osborne at Osborne, Inc., OSBORNEINK.com. If you go there, there is a link to the competition for a scholarship for Netroots Nation. Click it, please. Between the Horn and the Malloy Truth Seekers, we should be able to get Matt into the upper ranks of the competitors. Osborne, Inc., OSBORNEINK.com. Thanks to my head writer, David, in Tennessee. Thanks to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and ColRiverWind.org. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you.
With America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Monday, no it isn't, Tuesday night edition of The Horn. I have a feeling it's going to be confused like that all night and perhaps for the rest of the week. My apologies for my absence yesterday. Fact of the matter is, it was, look, the right wing can talk about family values all at once, but they ain't got a lock on it. In fact, I think we can make an argument with a few stories tonight that they have an active dislock on it, the dysfunctional or whatever. But anyway, I was off with Ferg last night. Here in the hills and hollers of wild, wonderful, almost level West by God, Virginia, we have a tradition, an educational tradition. It goes back to 1929, I think it is. I think it is the oldest program of its sort in the country. And it's something called the Golden Horseshoe Program. It's for eighth graders. And eighth grade children all across West Virginia study their little butts off for a test of information relating to West Virginia history, culture, and geography. And very few win the coveted Golden Horseshoe Award. Knights and ladies of the Golden Horseshoe, in fact, they are. And Ferg was one of them. So he was asked to attend the County Board of Education meeting last night, and we did, where he and his other county Golden Horseshoe recipients were honored with mention. And then this Friday, he gets knighted. That will not cause me to miss the show. This Friday, he gets knighted in a ceremony featuring the governor, et cetera, down in Charleston. I'll be gone to that. It was a sweet moment. It really, really was. Now, me having been gone last night is a reminder that I need to mention to you that there will be some scheduling weirdness coming in the next week or two. Let's see, next Monday and Tuesday, I will not be here. I will not be behind the microphone Monday or Tuesday of next week. I will be off in the wilds of Kentucky at a meeting, that which my attendance is required. So there's that. Then we'll have a normal Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. And then it gets weird again at the beginning of next week and throughout that week and the following week, the beginning of the week, because I'm going to be on the road doing some mountaintop removal-related stuff. More announcements coming, if anything broadcast-worthy comes out of all that. So stay tuned, stay posted. At the top of the next hour, we're going to be having a little conversation.